I'm John Scott. I'm a lawyer and a veterinarian. I do both. I represent plaintiffs in medical malpractice actions. I sue doctors, but not veterinarians. Physicians I sue, not veterinarians. I practice, work 2 days a week in a regular veterinary practice. I work 8 to 10 shifts a month at our local animal emergency clinic, and then I do some of the law work. This presentation is called Legislation and Issues Affecting Veterinary Medicine. This is kind of just some of the things that we think are coming along that we want to kind of get ready for. Some of these you've probably heard of before. They've been around for a couple of 3 years. Some of these things are fairly new. This probably is not going to take the entire time that's allotted, but let's kind of go through all of these. Some of these I'll just kind of tell you what the issue is. Some of them I'll give you an opinion on. And then at the end, let's do questions on all of them. So if you have a question, you kind of make a note to yourself, just so we can get through to the end. Otherwise, we may get stumped on the second topic and never make it to the rest of them. One thing is the changing legal status of animals. There are 70 law schools in the country now that have classes in animal law. In addition to that, a lot of the state bars have an animal law section. Texas has one. I addressed one of their meetings, and it was kind of Daniel in the lion's den. From a veterinary standpoint, a lot of the animal law sections in state bars or the animal law classes involve more animal rights activists that tend to be on the fringe. Many of them are wonderful people who are really in step with us, but many of them are not. So you have to be kind of careful with some of those, but that's all out there. The American Bar Association has established an award for excellence in the advancement of animal law, so they reward people that do a lot of good in that area. The ABA Animal Law Committee homepage states, "The status of animals in our legal system is in flux, and attorneys are discovering creative and interesting ways to use legal arguments in the face of increasingly complex scenarios." The AVMA has two attorneys on staff that review pending legislation that concerns attorneys. So this is just to remind you that legal issues are growing, and it's something that we all are going to have to be dealing with more and more as time goes by. One of them is the regulation of surgical procedures by governmental entities. You probably are familiar, if you read DVM magazine or some of the other journals, that West Hollywood, California, passed an ordinance prohibiting cat declawing within the city limits of West Hollywood, California. It was overturned. It first went through a regulatory agency who determined that the state board of veterinary medicine had the power to regulate the practice of veterinary medicine. Their authority was statewide, and they couldn't be overruled by municipalities. I'm not sure if that's finished yet. It could go from this regulatory agency to the court system, and I'm not sure where it's going in there, but I can't imagine the court system agreeing with them. The same West Hollywood municipal authority, whatever they were, let it be known that they also were going to outlaw tail docking and ear trims. You're probably aware there's many groups that want to outlaw almost any kind of cosmetic procedure. And so that, again, a lot of these we're just going to kind of skip through, make you aware that they're going on, because some of them, there's not anything real set yet. But whether the lack of success of West Hollywood will deter other places is hard to say, but it's one of the things that is going to be causing us problems. Performance of alternative medical procedures by non-veterinarians. This one is a bigger issue now. Chiropractors, physical therapists, equine dentists, herbalists, acupuncturists, all of these people see animals as a way to expand their practice. And they would like to start working on animals as well as people. What they are doing is putting in their practice act that they are allowed to work on animals. Some of them are including some very minimal requirements of some education regarding animals, but many of them are not. Many of them are just saying that chiropractors in the state of Oregon can work on animals. To counter that, many states are amending their Veterinary Practice Act to say that those particular procedures are the practice of veterinary medicine, and therefore we have the power to regulate those things. So there's going to be a fight between those. There also is some conflict between boards of pharmacy and veterinary boards. The pharmacy boards are saying, veterinarians can do this, and they can't do this, and they can't do this, as far as prescribing human medications, off-label things. The issue has come up in Texas as to whether a veterinarian can basically fill a prescription from another veterinarian. If someone has moved from another town and they bring with them a prescription for, or they're traveling is where we usually see it, and they run out of medication, and we call the veterinarian that has prescribed the medication, and he says, sure, it's fine to go ahead and fill that. If we don't see the animal and establish a doctor-patient relationship, can we fill that prescription? And the Texas Board of Pharmacy says, no, you cannot. You have to have a doctor-patient client relationship. You have to examine that animal before you can fill that prescription, because you cannot act as a pharmacist. The pharmacy board controls that, and we're not going to let you do it. It's always been the practice before. Sure, you can do that. This veterinarian has okayed it, and we can basically act as a pharmacist and simply fill the prescription without establishing the doctor-patient-client relationship. Kind of the same thing is happening on these other alternative medicine. You've seen a lot of this in the AVMA Journal and other media lately. Oh, well, the pharmacy board in Texas is saying you just can't do that. You've got to examine the animal. And if we do that, then we charge them an office call and that sort of thing. You know, it usually comes up with someone that's traveling and they just need, and with narcotics, I won't do it at all. But, you know, they're just out of amoxicillin and they still got the, and it's going to be 2 days till they give back. And as just to help them out, you know, you just give them a half a dozen amoxicillin and maybe not even charge them for it. And the pharmacy board in Texas is saying you can't do that. You've got to examine the animal before you can do anything, prescribing any kind of medication. So hard to tell what's going to happen with that. No, because and we're not doing it here, but I think at the last AHA 2 years ago, I did a program on the doctor-client-patient relationship. And in small animals, you cannot establish that without examining the animal. In large animals, herd situations, you get a little leeway there. If you've been working with that herd and that you know a certain disease is going through that herd, and the foreman calls you and says, we've got another one, can we get some more terramycin or whatever? And you say, sure, that's acceptable. In small animal medicine, it's almost impossible to establish that relationship without examining the animal. So, horse slaughter for food, there is a new website that I just became aware of the other day from some other people in our veterinary law group It's called Vets for Equine Welfare. I am not sure which side of this issue they come down on or whether they try to be neutral on it, but you're aware that one side is saying it's inhumane to be slaughtering these horses for food. We shouldn't be doing that when no one in this country eats horse meat anyway. We slaughter them, we send all the stuff to France. We shouldn't be doing that. The other side says if that option is not available, who's going to take care of these horses that are 12 years old and are going to live to 18? The owners don't want them anymore, or they wouldn't be sending them off for slaughter. So who's going to take care of them? Are we going to force the owner to? Is the state going to take care of them? Is some humane organization going to have to basically adopt that horse? So those are basically the two sides of the issue. As a lawyer, I can understand both of them, and I could argue very persuasively for either side. Which is right, which is wrong, I don't know. Hopefully some kind of a compromise on that, because each side has good points in that. But that's one thing you're going to be hearing more about. This I put in there just to make sure that you're aware of it. DNA testing to link zoonotic pathogens with their animal source. I've done some programs for Novartis where we emphasize the legal issues of zoonotic diseases, mostly from intestinal parasites, visceral larval migrans, cutaneous larval migrans, ocular larval migrans, that sort of thing. And a lot of veterinarians have kind of taken the position, well, if one of my clients' children gets one of those, I wish it hadn't happened, but it's going to be real difficult to prove that that came from that particular animal. It's not anymore. Current technology allows a laboratory to identify the specific animal that parasite came from. And so if someone's child comes down with ocular larval migrans, they got it from their dog, and they say, well, you never told me this would happen. You didn't suggest worming to them when you went through the series of vaccines. You may be in trouble for that. So just be aware that is out there now. Recovery of non-economic damages for animals injured or killed by veterinary negligence. This, of course, has been going on for some time. They're making some progress in different areas, and it's going to be kind of a piecemeal thing over the next few years. How far it'll go, we don't know. A couple of years ago, California introduced legislation that would allow for the recovery of up to $25,000 of non-economic damages for injury or death of a pet. Non-economic damages, we're talking about pain and suffering. This is the owner has a child, and this is the child's pet, and through a veterinary negligence, the animal dies. At the present time, all you can recover is, all the owner can recover, is the value of the animal. If there was treatment involved after the negligence, they can recover the cost of that veterinary care, a few other things. But you can't recover pain and suffering of how much I'm going to miss my dog for the little girl because animals are considered property. We assume that at some point people are going to be able to recover those non-economic damages. It's going to happen one of two ways, either through legislation like was proposed in California, or through what we call case law, where judges decide. And there are some judges who have already awarded non-economic damages to people involving the harm or death of a pet. At the present time, all of those cases have been overturned by appellate courts who say, no, you can't do that. You are all familiar, I'm sure, of the argument between pretty much Republicans and Democrats of judicial activism, where the Republicans accuse Democratic judges of enacting laws through their judicial decisions. Instead of deciding what the law says they ought to decide, they decide according to their personal opinions. Democrats tend to say, no, that doesn't happen, and that's just the normal evolution of things, and so on. Be aware, though, that often judges will decide things based on their own personal opinions, sometimes based on the facts of the case, and it's just one of those weird cases. There was a case, I don't think it's in any of these materials, and I can't remember where it was from, but the case basically said that a goldfish was a companion animal. And the facts of the case were, I think it was a single mom, had a daughter and a boyfriend. The boyfriend became enraged at something and beat up on the mom. I don't think he beat up on the kid, but to do what damage he could to the kid. The kid had a pet goldfish, loved the goldfish. He dumped the goldfish out on the floor and stomped on it. There was statute in that state that allowed for recovery of non-economic damages for abuse of a companion animal. So this wasn't a negligence case, it was abuse, and it did allow for non-economic damages. In order to award some money to this mother and her daughter and punish the guy who had stomped on the goldfish, the judge said, yes, a goldfish is a companion animal. So now that case is out there that says a goldfish is a companion animal. Well, how far are we going to go with that? Are tarantulas companion animals? Are snakes? Are fleas? Are hermit crabs? You know, how far do we go with companion animals? I tell you that just to show you that judicial decisions are not necessarily the way to go, in my opinion. In my opinion, we need to do what California started to do, and that is introduce legislation, because in general, legislation from legislative bodies has at least been discussed. There are compromises. We hope they come up with something reasonable. It is not just one judge making a decision that may last forever. This proposal was supported by the California VMA for the reasons that I've told you. We assume this is coming. Let's get something that we can live with and then go on from there. $25,000 is not that hard to live with. Our insurance rates are not going to go up very much if a court is allowed to award as much as $25,000. Look at the difference between what we pay as small animal practitioners and what equine practitioners pay when there is the possibility of million-dollar judgments. There's a big difference when you compare them, but it's still not all that much that equine practitioners pay. So it's not going to affect things that much. And a lot of us, thought this was a good idea. And the California VMA thought it was. The drug companies came in and lobbied against it, and the bill was defeated. So now California is right back where everyone else is. There's no law of any kind, case law or statutory law, that says what they're going to do. Question was, why were the drug companies lobbying against the bill? They didn't want to be sued for drug reactions. We talked about last time, in the last session, NSAIDs, Rimadyl. Again, it goes back to Susie's dog that she had lived with since she was 4 years old, and now she's 12, and it died because you gave it Rimadyl, and it died of liver failure. Not only is the veterinarian going to be sued, but the drug company is going to be sued as well, and they didn't want to do that. And apparently they thought $25,000 was too much. So, again, that, you know, we'd like to have that maybe $10,000, but, you know, $25,000 I think we can live with. And it's going to happen one way or another. Whether it's going to be 2 years from now or 15 is what we don't know, and how much it's going to be. There is one state, and I cannot remember where it is, I don't have it in here, that proposed legislation allowing up to $250,000, 10 times this amount. I think that was defeated, or it's still in the process, one or the other. But that is the amount that President Bush has recommended for people in medical malpractice cases, a cap of $250,000 in, you know, for anyone who is, because of negligence, is confined to a wheelchair for the rest of their life. $250,000 is the maximum that a court could allow under that proposal, and this state, whichever it was wanting to allow the same thing for the death of an animal or injury. Connecticut court has allowed punitive damages in a veterinary negligence case. They actually had a statute in Connecticut that allowed punitive damages if the veterinarian did not live up to the standard of care. I can't remember exactly the language that was in the statute, but the court found that the language of the statute was satisfied, so they allowed punitive damages. If you're not aware, punitive damages are punishment, and that is where a lot of these tobacco cases now are coming out. I saw the other day that, there was one that was a $200 million verdict or something like that for someone who had died from smoking. The court is only giving them maybe, you know, $1 million for the actual damages to that person and to their family and so on. The rest is punishment to tell the tobacco companies, don't do this anymore. And we could get into a long discussion of punitive damages, but they did allow it in this Connecticut case. There was legislation introduced in Massachusetts and New York probably 3 years ago now, and luckily it was defeated, but I want to tell you just to give you an idea of what's been proposed. This is a little wordy, but a person who by willful, wanton, reckless, or negligent act or omission injures or causes or procures to be injured an animal companion shall be liable in damages for the expenses of veterinary and other special medical care required, the loss of reasonably expected society, companionship, comfort, protection, and services, that's non-economic damages, of the injured animal to his or her human companions, pain, suffering, emotional distress, and consequential damages sustained by the animal's human companion. Pain, suffering, and loss of faculties sustained by the animal. Court costs, attorney's fees, and other reasonable damages. Now, the first part of that, the damages sustained by the animal's human companion, are what we've been talking about. Little Susie's dog dies, and she's going to miss the dog, so we ought to compensate her for her loss of companionship of her animal. But the last part of that, pain and suffering and loss of faculties sustained by the animal, that means the animal gets money damages for its own pain and suffering and its own disability, not to the owner, but paid to the animal. The statute went ahead and said, what we're going to do is establish a trust for the animal with the money that's awarded to the animal. And that money will be used for the care of the animal for the rest of its life. If there's any money left over at the end, it goes to a designated humane association. So not only were they going to allow the owner and the family to recover for loss of companionship, pain and suffering for them, but they were going to allow the animal to recover for its own pain and suffering. If you had asked any veterinary lawyer when that would happen, we would have said 15 years at the earliest, 25, 50 years from now before that would happen, and here they proposed it 2 or 3 years ago. Like I say, it was defeated. I don't know that it ever came to a vote. I think it died in committee. But it shows you what some people are trying to do in this area. And that was what we were just talking about. I put two slides in and didn't realize it was all together in one. Veterinary medicine in humane shelters. California has what they call a Hayden Bill. It sets standards for shelter medicine. Basically requires every shelter to hire a veterinarian or have one on retainer. The veterinarian might be liable for what the shelter does to the animal and open to board action for malpractice. Not so much of your what you specifically do, but supposedly the shelter is now under your supervision. And if they do things wrong and an animal is harmed, the veterinarian might be held liable for that. So if you're practicing shelter medicine, you need to do that to the very same standard that you do in your own practice. Don't say, well, I'm doing this at a reduced fee, and I'm really doing it just out of kindness to help some of these animals. You could be at risk for practicing at a lower standard and there than you do in your own practice. Records, lab tests, imaging, all that needs to be up to the same standard. Animal ownership during and after disasters, this has really become prominent lately, prompted, of course, by Hurricane Katrina. Hawaii, Louisiana, New Hampshire have passed legislation addressing issues of providing shelter to pets. The Federal Pet Evacuation and Transportation Standards Act directs FEMA to withhold funding from local and state agencies that don't include animals in their disaster plans. There's a lot of questions here. We discussed this at our last Veterinary Law Association meeting in Hawaii, and one of our members, our current president, was involved in the relief work there in Louisiana. And a lot of these questions came up, and they're still coming up. Who can take an animal that's abandoned? When someone goes through an area that's flooded like that and people have left and there's animals there, who's qualified to take that animal? Can just anyone pick one up? Does it have to be a humane society? Once the animal is taken out of there, who owns it? Who has responsibility for taking care of it? If some good Samaritan picks up an animal and takes it out of there, have they assumed ownership of it? What happens with that? Are there limits to where the animal can be taken? The animals from Louisiana and Mississippi were spread out all over the country to humane organizations that were able to handle them. The humane organizations in Texas, Oklahoma, right in that area couldn't handle them all. There were some, I think, that went to Oregon, places like that. Are we going to place a limit on where those animals can be taken to? What records do you have to keep? Do you have to keep very specific records on the address where the animal was picked up, the date it was picked up, whether it had a collar on, what information was on the collar, all sorts of things like that? What do you have to do to reunite the owners with the animals? If someone comes up 2 years after the disaster and says, by the way, my animal, I left it there in New Orleans. Can you find out if it's still around? Do they have to have some master database where they can find that out and know if their animal is now in Oregon? If it is in Oregon, do they have to bring it back and give it back to the people? Or do you assume, are all these questions answered by the fact that if the owner left the animal there, it's free game. Anyone that picks it up is the owner. They have no obligation to give it back or anything like that. A lot of questions that are really going to have to be answered on that. Owner-guardian issues, you've been hearing about this for some time. Various municipalities mostly have passed legislation. Now there are no pet owners. They are pet guardians. West Hollywood, again, has done that. Berkeley, you might expect. Chicago, Sherwood, Arkansas. I don't even know how to pronounce that in Wisconsin. The entire state of Rhode Island has passed that legislation. They are now pet guardians instead of pet owners. So the question now is, is that really an issue, or is it just semantics? Does it matter what we call the person who takes care of the animal, whether we call him an owner or a guardian? The problem is that there is a whole area of law pertaining to guardians and wards in people. We mentioned in the last session that any time there are judicial decisions concerning human medicine, if the same issue comes up in veterinary medicine, they just reach over and grab that issue out of human medicine and bring it into veterinary medicine, whether it's informed consent or negligence or whatever. Are they going to do that here? Once we call people a guardian, are they now a guardian under the law, or are they just called a guardian? If they're a guardian under the law, then can third parties come in? If I am a guardian for my cousin, because my cousin is mentally impaired, or my spouse, or my grandmother, or whatever, I have certain responsibilities to take care of that person when I'm the guardian. They are called my ward. If I'm not doing my job, a third party can come in and go to court, and the court will either tell me to straighten up and fly right and treat my ward and take care of them like I should, or they will appoint a different guardian. So transfer that to veterinary medicine. If we call what we now call owners, if they are now guardians, can your next door neighbor who thinks you're not taking care of your animal right because you leave it outside when it gets down to 40 degrees at night, can they go into court and have you removed as that animal's guardian, or make you provide some kind of a heated shelter for that animal, or whatever? It opens up a vast area of law that, if it's all transferred from the current guardian ward law into veterinary medicine, just because we call these persons guardians instead of owners, it's really going to be some problems. Yes, a question from the lawyer. Another question, you know, that the question was, how does it affect breeders since you can't buy or sell a guardianship? And that's basically the problem with all of this, is that animals are property. And you cannot put all of that together sometimes with the fact that they're property. And it's the same thing with awarding the non-economic damages. I just bought a 1971 Corvette, and I really like that car. But if I have a wreck with somebody, all the insurance company is going to pay for, or the person driving the other car, if it's their fault, all they're going to pay for is the value of that car. And it's not worth all that much. The fact that I really, really like that car doesn't mean anything. They're not going to give me $25,000 just because I really like that car. Animals being property, the same principle applies. As long as animals are property, we're not going to give you non-economic damages for the harm to that property because we don't do it for any other property. So what's the solution to that? I don't know. There are proposals to call animals sentient property, that they can sense pain and feel, and create a new kind of property, and then once we've created that new kind of property, now we can do other statutes and law regarding only that kind of property. That may be what happens, I don't know. But right now there is a huge conflict between the fact that we as veterinarians promote the human-animal bond, and we tell people your animals are part of your family and you need to take care of them that way. But as soon as we're negligent and we harm that animal, we turn around and say, oh no, they're property. All we owe you is the value of the property. And there is a very basic conflict there. And how we're going to straighten that out, I don't know. But, yes. By the way, since it is St. Patrick's Day, Happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you. You've heard the saying of the wind at your back and the road downhill and all. I hope you find your pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Okay, question. Oh, let me say that real quick. We talked about this in the last session. If you're here for every session, I apologize for going through all of this every time, but we tend to have different people in every session, so we'll do it again. The American Veterinary Medical Law Association is a group of right now about 200 people who are interested in legal issues. About 40 or 50 of those 200 have both degrees, veterinary and law. The other 150 are either lawyers or veterinarians or students or state associations or whatever who are interested in legal issues. We have a website, avmla.org. If these talks interest you, go to that website, get a little information about our group. We meet every year with the AVMA convention. We're going to be in Washington, D.C. This year. Last year we were in Hawaii. It was a great excuse to go to Hawaii. It's a really good excuse to go to Washington, D.C., also one of my favorite places. So think about that. Go to our website. Check on there. We have a newsletter that covers a lot of these emerging issues and really will kind of keep you up to date on a lot of this stuff that's going on. So now, questions. How much time do we have?
7 minutes.
Perfect. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, this the discussion was there about the horse slaughtering. That's an issue, like I say, that has very good points on both sides, and I don't know what the solution is going to be to that. And there, you know, that it's just now coming to the forefront, and it's going to be with us for a while, and hopefully we can do that through some federal legislation that is well thought out. Rather than, again, doing it piecemeal so that in one state you do one thing and in another state you do something totally different, and that encourages people to truck them five states away, which is its own problem. Exactly, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's a really thorny one, and I could argue either side of that. And I don't know where I stand on that right now. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, and I think the issue in the horses comes down to they're basically saying it's too easy to send the horses off for slaughter instead of having them put down on your own property where you have to deal with it, watch them die, whatever. Sending them off to slaughter seems to be an easy way to do it. And I don't think anyone's arguing with, you know, if they really need to be euthanized, that's fine. I think they're saying that's an easy solution and we shouldn't let people do that. You know, but the same issue in small animals is, you know, do you euthanize everything that the animal, that the owner comes in and asks you to, or do you have certain criteria that they have to meet as far as pain and suffering, you know, things, vicious animal, you know, whatever. And those are all ethical issues rather than legal issues. And that's where we have problems in law, is where ethical issues come up against legal issues, and it obviously happens all the time. I mean, you get into the issue of euthanasia of people. Same thing, you know. What there is certainly the potential for abuse if you do. Is it Oregon that has legislation that allows for that assisted suicide and so on? Certainly, we can abuse that. But is that enough reason to not have that option? So, you know, those are the things that, like I say, you can argue both sides of very vehemently, and you're not wrong on either side. There's good and bad points for for everything. Yes?
Have any of those communities that you said have changed the wording of ownership to guardianship run into? How have they dealt with some of these?
I'm not aware that that issue has really come up. The question was if these municipalities who have changed from owner to guardian, how are they handling that? And I'm not sure that that issue has yet come up. I think so far it is just semantics. And the argument is if we tell people they are guardians, it indicates they have a little higher standard to take care of the animal than if we call them an owner. If I have whatever property I have, I can do whatever I want to with it. If I want to drive my car off a cliff, I can do it. There are regulations on what you can do with an animal. Obviously, you can't abuse them. You can't let them suffer, things like that. You have to have them vaccinated for rabies. You have to register them in some municipalities. So there are laws regarding what you can do with your property. I have to register my car, too, and I have to put a tag on it. So, you know, there are laws regulating what you can do with property. But so far, I think it is all semantics. But there's that big question out there. And as we talked about, it was the first of this presentation. There are animal rights groups out there that would like to take advantage of some of those things. And I'm not aware that they have done it yet, but it probably will happen. Exactly. The question was, what happens to the pet if someone decides you aren't a good guardian? And that's part of the problem. Does it go to a humane association? Is the state going to support that animal if the court decides that you're not doing it right? Can the court force you to do different? Can they force you to not feed old Roy and feed something else instead? You know, those are all unanswered questions. And that's basically this whole presentation is these are unanswered questions right now. This is just to let you know some of the things that are coming down the pike so you can start thinking about them so that maybe you can have an opinion on some of these things. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, more and more we're going to have to be involved in our local and state politics and legislation to know what's going on. And most state associations have a veterinarian or a lawyer, excuse me, and hopefully they are keeping up with that. And you ought to know that lawyer's name. And when an issue like this comes up, get on the phone and call that person and say, what's going on with this? And volunteer to that person to say, you know, when issues come up before the legislature that are important to veterinary medicine, call me. I'm willing to buttonhole people and make sure that we have some representation. At least we're heard before that legislation is passed. And we've had that come up in Texas, and I've talked to our counsel for the Texas VMA on a couple of three issues, and luckily we've agreed on them, and they have been able to be worked out. Oh yeah, and that's a problem too. Yeah, and that obviously is the thing with the horse slaughter. There's a lot of disagreements among veterinarians, let alone outside.